In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we've heard a lot about 9/11. We've seen the hearings. Today on Flashpoints, we're going to take a look at an interesting new book that is an in-depth investigation. The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. This is a book by David Ray Griffin. He's a professor of philosophy and theology at Claremont School of Theology in California. The book is called A Sober Yet Startling Analysis of Information Drawn from Researches Around the World That Reaches One Major Conclusion. The Fourth Estate, that's me, that's us, that's the journalist. The Fourth Estate has failed miserably in its duty to ask uncomfortable questions of the government about the events of September 11th. Well, we're going to ask some of those questions today, and we're very interested in getting more background, and we're going to be doing a lot of reporting on the hearings, on the incident, on what we knew and when we knew it, and what the administration did or didn't do around September 11th. David Ray Griffin, I want to welcome you for joining us on Flashpoints.
I'm glad to be with you.
Well, let's begin at the beginning. You call this book The New Pearl Harbor. Why did you name that book that way?
It has two meanings. One meaning is just the simple, straightforward fact that all sorts of people have called it the New Pearl Harbor. Even, we are told, President Bush, the very night of 9/11, before he went to bed, wrote in his diary, "I believe the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century happened today." So that meaning is not controversial. But a second meaning comes from a document written by the group called the Project for the New American Century, which involves people such as Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Pearl, who argued in a document they produced called Rebuilding America's Defenses that we needed to put tremendous amount of money into military affairs in terms of what they call the revolution in military affairs, which includes the weaponization of space, which has been estimated to cost maybe around $1 trillion just initially. And so they said, well, this revolution in military affairs will probably go quite slowly, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event such as a new Pearl Harbor.
All right, and just one more question as a way of background. You tend to write books about theology and philosophy. Why did you choose to weigh in after 20 books on such other subjects? Why did you choose to weigh in on this?
Like most Americans, I think, I had pretty much accepted the official theory, official account of what happened on 9/11. We were all in shock, and it was very difficult to conceive the idea that there might have been some official complicity there. I had heard off and on that there were people arguing that, but I dismissed it. Finally, though, a professor I had met at a conference, whom I knew to be reasonable, sent me a email with a website on there that pointed me to this website by Paul Thompson called Was 9/11 Allowed to Happen? And he has compiled a 200-page single-space timeline of all the events that he found relevant to this issue. And I was rather amazed to find how much evidence pointed in this direction. So I decided I should try to write a little summary article just to point people to the existence of this. Now, you point out this is very different from my previous books. That is true, but in one sense, it's not so different, because whether one's talking about the mind-body problem or the existence of God or the reality of life after death, it's a matter of looking at the relevant evidence and seeing what is the most probable theory given all the arguments pro and con on a certain thing. So here I was just dealing with a different kind of evidence.
All right, let's get into the substance of your book, The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. Let's deal with the sweeping assertions. We have heard many times by many critics of the investigation that not only did the administration have information that would lead them to worry about airliners and planes being smashed into buildings being used as missiles, but that in fact there was prior knowledge about this specific incident that happened on 9/11, and that because these extreme right-wingers could use this, could make hay with such an incident, they could make war on the world, they could act on beliefs regarding attacking Iraq and Afghanistan, that they let it happen. What do we know about that?
Well, there are lots of ways to approach this. One is just to look at the difference between what in fact was known about the likelihood of such events and the administration's flat denials that this idea of using hijacked airplanes to create terrorist events had ever been talked about. So first of all, it's just very puzzling why the administration felt it was necessary to conceal the fact that all sorts of people knew, and this has been discussed a lot. The more disturbing thing has to do with some apparently specific information that they should have had. One report, just take an example, there are several FBI men who cannot tell their story for fear of prosecution, but they have gotten David Shippers, very well-known lawyer, who has in fact prosecuted Clinton in the impeachment trial, and they have told him that they knew at least a month ahead of time that there was going to be an attack in, quote, lower Manhattan. And Shippers reports that he tried to alert the attorney general to this and many times, and nobody would return his calls. A further disturbing bit of evidence here is the fact that these put options on American Airlines and United Airlines went through the roof in the 2 days before 9/11. Now, a put option is when you are betting that the stock of a company is going to go way down. And when you look at what was purchased there, somebody was making in the tens of millions of dollars with the apparent knowledge that American Airlines and United Airlines stock, and of course those were the two airlines involved in the crashes, were going to go down. And so that seemed to be very specific information, particularly when you combine it with the fact that the put options were also purchased for Dean Witter, which occupied 22 floors of the World Trade Center. So that suggested not only were airplanes to be used, but they were to be used against the World Trade Center. So that is pretty specific information.
Now, I want to come back, if we could, for a moment, to the first part of what you said. There's the attorney, David Shippers. He's representing FBI agents who are saying that they had specific information about an attack in which, I guess, airplanes would be or airliners would be weaponized and used as missiles to attack, that they had information about this kind of attack. They attempted, through an attorney, to approach their own government and receive no response?
That appears to be the case. That is what Shippers has reported.
And who are these agents?
Well, I don't know. And, of course, it would be very dangerous for their names to be revealed. So on this one, as with everything else in the book, for the most part, I am just reporting what other people have reported that seems to have some sort of initial plausibility. But I can't imagine any reason why David Shippers would concoct a fabrication about such a thing.
Given that he is such a high-paid, successful, impressive Washington attorney with an incredible career.
That's right. He would have nothing to gain from this and a lot to lose. Also, as I report in the book, a fairly right-wing publication has printed a story which confirms the story where they had interviewed some of the FBI men in question.
All right. In discussing how the attacks of 9/11 could have occurred, you say that the question is whether the successes of the attacks were due to a breakdown or a stand down. We've heard a lot about the breakdown. You talk about how somehow there was a massive breakdown involving intelligence agencies, the Immigration Service, the FAA. But describe the difference between a breakdown and a stand down. And what are you saying about a stand down?
Okay, a stand down would be canceling standard operating procedures. This is a technical term, SOP. And standing operating procedures related to airliners that have possibly been hijacked. So the procedure is that if an FAA, Federal Aviation Administration controller, spots some danger sign that suggests that an airline has possibly been hijacked, he or she is immediately to contact the military, NORAD, and also the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon, and alert them to this fact. Then NORAD immediately tells the nearest Air Force base to scramble, that is, send up jet fighters to intercept this possibly hijacked airliner. And then there are standard operating procedures for signaling, which all pilots know. So the jet fighter, one of them gets in front of the plane and rocks its wings, which says, "You've been intercepted, follow me." If the plane does not obey, then they fire warning shots. If the plane does not obey, then the pilot gets authorization from the Pentagon to shoot the plane down. Well, this simply did not happen. Normally, these intercepts occur within 10 minutes. It all occurs very quickly. And yet, to take the example of the first airliner, Flight 11, was known at 8:14 to have been possibly hijacked. It did not hit the North Tower until 8:46. That is 32 minutes. That is inexplicable. Even at 8:21 was when the plane was known to be definitely hijacked. There were still 25 minutes until it hit the North Tower. So researchers look at that and say, how can we possibly explain why that didn't happen unless there was a stand down? And then that gets even more persuasive when you look at the second and third and fourth flights.
So how do you explain a stand down? What would be the reason that could be given that the administration would not follow these long-standing procedures?
Okay, that's a good question because it gets into the very nature of my book. I do not, in my book, present an alternative account of what really happened. So I don't try to get into the administration's mind or the Pentagon's mind or anyone's mind to try to figure out what they were thinking. I just report the fact that there appear to be these standard operating procedures, and those standard operating procedures obviously either were not followed that day, or there had to be such a massive breakdown, and a breakdown that coincidentally occurred four times in the same morning, and that becomes increasingly difficult to believe, that after two airplanes have hit the World Trade Center, that still no planes were set up in relation to the other flights.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. That's the voice of David Ray Griffin. He's got a brand new book. He's the author of many books. And this one's a little bit different. It's called The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. I want to stray from the book a moment and ask you about the hearings. For the last 2 days, we broadcast on Pacifica Radio the 9/11 hearings, the commission's investigation chaired by the former mayor of New Jersey, Governor Kane, into what was going on. The star witness appeared yesterday. His name is Richard Clark. He's been all over the front pages. He's the former counterterrorism czar under Bush. He's got a brand new book, Against All Enemies. Now, here is somebody who was inside the administration, several administrations, on the front lines dealing with terrorism. One has to wonder whether somebody, an attorney, a respected attorney like David Shipler, comes forward representing FBI agents who have information about a specific attack, one would think that they would try and reach somebody like Richard Clark. Give us your response to Clark and how his information fits into this puzzle.
Yes, I found it very interesting. And from my point of view, the most interesting thing about it is it fits rather hand in glove with the account that I give in Chapter 7 of my book, in which I do lay out what other researchers have laid out as possible motives if the Bush administration did deliberately allow or even cause these events to happen, what motives might they have had? I list four major ones. One of them had to do with the fact, which has been reported by many people, including Paul O'Neill in the recent book in which he's the major figure, that the administration from day one was obsessed with Iraq and wanted to attack Iraq. And I report in my book lots of evidence that through the years that these people were out of power during the Clinton years, they were militating for an attack on Iraq. They even wrote Clinton a letter urging him to attack Iraq. There was a lot of desire to get geopolitical control there and also, of course, control of the oil. So Clark gives much more support to that hypothesis, saying that that's what he found from the very beginning, too, that they, most of them, were much more obsessed with going to Iraq, even though, as he pointed out, Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11.
Well, talk about the other points that you make in that Chapter 7 about the logic here.
Well, another motive could well have been to support this American-sponsored pipeline to run through Afghanistan, which would bring this oil, which they think may be the other biggest reserve of oil in the world, where it would run down through Pakistan and Afghanistan so that, therefore, it would not run through Russia or some other country. The negotiations with the Taliban had broken down, and UNICAL, the leader of the consortium, had pulled out and said they will not go ahead with the project because they didn't believe the Taliban provide sufficient stability in the country. In July of 2001, reported this meeting that occurred in Berlin, in which the American representatives evidently told the Taliban where they had tried to work out a deal where they would share power with other members of Afghanistan political circles, that if you won't accept our carpet of gold, we will bury you in a carpet of bombs. And that they also told a representative from Pakistan there that this attack on Afghanistan would occur in October, that is, before the snows started. And indeed, with 9/11 happening on 9/11, the military was able to get prepared to begin the attack on October 7th. So that looks like another of these many, many coincidences one has to stomach if one believes that all of this was purely coincidental.
You devote an entire chapter to President Bush's behavior on 9/11. What was there about his behavior that has raised suspicions for you?
Well, this is one of the strangest things about the official story, because the official story was that as Bush was going down to this school in Sarasota, Florida, they learned of the attacks only when they arrived at the school. And here the report was that the World Trade Center had been hit. One might think that that would lead to a change of plans, but no. The decision was to go ahead. The president had planned a photo opportunity where he was to listen to second graders read, and this was to be able to promote his education policy. And so they began that session, and then Andrew Card came in and whispered in his ear, telling him that a second plane had hit the World Trade Center. At that time, earlier Bush had said, oh, what a horrible accident. And so it wasn't surprising that he went ahead. But when two planes have hit the World Trade Center, you know it's not an accident. Also, by then, they knew that a third airplane had been hijacked. What is most puzzling, if this was all a surprise, they did not know how many airplanes had been hijacked. There might have been a dozen hijacked airplanes. In fact, at one stage, there was a rumor that there were that many. And if you were a terrorist, what better target than the President of the United States? The whole country who was paying attention knew where Bush was that day. That was much publicized. He was to then have a television conference right at the end of the photo op. And so anybody who had wanted to know where Bush was that day would have known. There would have been no defense if an airplane had crashed into the school, killing Bush and his entourage and all of the teachers and children. And yet they stayed there for the whole hour with no sense of urgency whatsoever. Now, there was a Secret Service guy, when he heard about the crash into the World Trade Center, evidently said, when he heard about the second one, we're out of here. But if he did say that, he was obviously overruled by whoever was in charge of the Secret Service detail that day, because they allowed Bush to stay there for another 45 minutes.
One of the more controversial chapters of your book has to do with what happened at the Pentagon on that day. And you have suggested that it wasn't struck by Flight 77, that's the official account, but it was hit by a missile. Now, some would say that's one of those kinds of crazy conspiracy theories that has no backing or logic. Why would you give so much attention to that?
I myself, even after I had started studying about the attacks on the World Trade Centers, when I first heard that theory, which had been promulgated by this French researcher at the Voltaire Network, Thierry Masson, I thought, that has to be nuts, because the size of a hole that would be created by a Boeing 757 would be enormous. And all sorts of people would have seen it. And so how could anybody, if it had really been a missile, which created a rather small hole, how could anybody expect to fawn that story off on the public? And nevertheless, I thought, well, I'll go ahead and get the book. First book was called Pentagate, and its second book is called 9/11, The Big Lie. And I found between those two books that there's an enormous amount of physical evidence does suggest that the official account cannot be true. First of all, the official account we read in the Washington Post the very day after 9/11, that the hole was 5 stories high and 200 feet wide. And yet there are photographs, not taken by left-wing conspiracy theorists, but by a photographer for the Associated Press, that shows that the hole is no more than 18 feet in diameter. And so this is one of those terrible disconnects between physical evidence and the official account.
Now, regarding the situation of the airliner in Pennsylvania.
In fact, let me go ahead and say a little more about the Pentagon, the physical evidence, because it's rather overwhelming. Another part of it is that whatever hit the Pentagon went through 3 of the 5 rings of the Pentagon, that is, through the C ring. In other words, that means it went through 6 reinforced walls. The nose of a Boeing 757 is fragile. That's where all the communications equipment is. And it would not be able to pierce through that many buildings. Secondly, even if you said, okay, somehow maybe this one had an extra strong nose and did pierce through, when you superimpose a picture of a 757 onto a picture of the Pentagon, you see that only the nose of the 757 would have gone inside the building. That means the rest of the airplane would have been sitting outside in full view. And yet there are several photographs of the scene, and there is absolutely no sign of a plane whatsoever. No fuselage, no wings, no engines, no tail. How could a Boeing 757 with a wingspan of 125 feet and a height of 40 feet slip inside a hole that is no more than 18 feet in diameter.
Well, now let's turn our attention to that other flight in Pennsylvania. I started to ask you about Flight 93. Now, this is a situation where there's emerging information that, in fact, this flight may have been shot down when it didn't need to be shot down. What can you say about whether it was a crash or a shoot down?
Yes, this is the puzzling thing about this flight, whereas the puzzling thing about the first three flights is why weren't they shot down? The puzzling thing here is it seems like this is the one flight that should not have been shot down because it appeared that the passengers were about to gain control, and yet lots of evidence suggests that it, in fact, was shot down.
Well, talk a little bit about the evidence. What would lead you to believe that, in fact, it was a shoot-down?
Okay. First of all, one needs to know that the FBI was listening in to the phone calls from the passengers to their spouses and to airline officials. And it was just as the men had decided that they were going to rush the hijackers, try to overpower them and force their way into the cockpit. And one woman then was saying, "They're doing it, they're doing it, they're doing it." And right after that, then the line went dead and there was a sound of wind, I should say. There was a big sound and then a sound of a whooshing sound, and then the everything went dead. On the ground, people reported seeing things fly out of the airplane many miles before it crashed, which suggests that it in fact had been holed. And so debris from the airplane was found as far as 8 miles away. Furthermore, one of the engines was found more than a mile away from the crash site. And that's particularly important because if it were downed by a missile, it probably would have been a heat-seeking missile, which would have sought out, of course, one of the engines. Furthermore, witnesses on the ground said that after the crash, they saw a little plane that appeared to be a military fighter jet flying over the scene and then flying off. Others on the ground said that they heard sounds. One guy who had been in Vietnam said he heard a sound that was just like a missile that he heard dozens of times in Vietnam. So between the evidence from inside and the evidence on the ground, it does appear that unless someone can explain it in some other way, that the plane was shot down.
That's the voice of David Ray Griffin. His book, The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, comes out of Interlink Press, and we are speaking about 9/11 and the commission after 2 days of hearings. I know in reporting for a long time about the Mujahideen and about the way in which the U.S. government and U.S. intelligence participated in such an active way with the purging of the Soviets out of Afghanistan, we learn a great deal about the CIA's relationship to the Pakistan intelligence services, a long-standing relationship that includes a massive amount of training and sort of collaborative operations. Now there appears to be an indication that the Pakistanis or some members of that intelligence group were actually a part of the preparation for the attacks. What do we know about this, and why would the administration cover this up?
There are several disturbing bits of information relevant to this. One is a story reported by an FBI agent that he overheard and, in fact, recorded a discussion in 1999 of agents of the ISI, which, as you say, is the Pakistani equivalent of the CIA and had, in fact, been trained by the CIA, who looked at the towers and said, "Those buildings are coming down." So if that story is true, it would appear that the plans had been made even before the Bush administration took office, that at least somebody had plans to do this. The other major factor is that something that has not been reported very widely is that the chief of the ISI, General Mahmoud Ahmad, had been meeting in Washington, D.C. the whole week of September 11th. From September 4th through September 9th, he was meeting with George Tenet. And then he stayed, and so he was in Washington during 9/11, stayed a few more days. And when there were questions then about his presence in Washington, there were apparent attempts to cover this fact up. For example, in one recording, when a reporter asked Condoleezza Rice about the presence of the ISI chief in Washington and asked whether she met with him, the recording that the news people got from the White House of this interview had that one statement inaudible that identified the person as the ISI chief. And this is particularly significant because we then later learned that this ISI chief had ordered Saeed Sheikh, another ISI agent, to wire $100,000 to Mohammed Atta, who, of course, was considered the ringleader of the hijackers. So this was kept all silent, and then Mahmoud Ahmad was quietly removed, apparently, as the ISI chief when this story started to break. And India reports that he was removed at the request of the United States government.
And following along this line of U.S. officials defending their friends or defending relationships or people in other governments who have multi-purposes in their relationship with the U.S. government, that takes us to the bin Laden family, this flight in which a number of members of the bin Laden family and others were taken out of the country right after 9/11. We see the administration going light on the Saudis. What can you say about the Saudi connection, about this flight, and who might have been on it, who the U.S. government was defending in taking these people, the bin Ladens, out of the country?
This is a subject I'm not very conversant on. I do know that there are many reports, and I cite evidence about this, suggesting that the official account of bin Laden as being a black sheep who was disowned by his family, that those stories are not true. Secondly, the idea that bin Laden was, you know, wanted dead or alive and was the number one object of search is rendered puzzling by a report from a very well-known and respected Swiss reporter that in the summer, July of 2001, bin Laden was actually a patient at a United States hospital in Dubai, that is in the United Arab Emirates. He was treated by an American doctor, and the report says he was visited by the local CIA agent, as well as the member of Saudi intelligence. So there is a lot of evidence that the official account is not true.
All right, let's step back now and let me ask you the big question and see how you can help us put this into perspective. You know, in the days of Watergate, the question was, what did the president know and when did he know it? I would like you to take a few minutes to talk about what the administration, what the president, what people apparently knew, and when they knew it.
This is a big question, as you know, that I devote an entire chapter to. So one of the questions is, did they even know the possibility of such an attack? So a very strange thing is there's all sorts of evidence that this had been highly discussed. They had at the Pentagon had drills, because the Pentagon was jokingly known as Ground Zero. Everybody knew that if terrorists were successful in hijacking airplanes, the Pentagon would certainly be one of the prime targets. So it's very puzzling that they tried to claim that they didn't even know that this was a possibility. As to what they actually knew, there are just different bits of evidence that suggest that the official story isn't true. One of those was that on July 26th, Attorney General Ashcroft quit flying airplanes in commercial airliners, and that this was based on his knowledge of threats. And as Dan Rather pointed out, this is rather disturbing to learn this, that he had this information and didn't share it with the rest of America, so we had to take our chances. Also, there is the pretty well documented report that on the day of 9/11 itself, some members of the Pentagon were ready to go on a flight and canceled that flight at the last minute. So those are a couple indications, and again, readers will have to, you know, work through the evidence and look up the references and see what kind of documentation there is for all this.
Many of the family members and others who have been watching this very closely and watching the 9/11 investigation, the formal investigation very closely, are very disappointed with what they saw in the last couple of days. They've been very disappointed about the mandate given to the commission, about the amount of time, the energy, the resources. Let me ask you, do we need another investigation? And what specific questions do you believe need to be answered in a thorough manner?
Well, my whole book is about a large number of questions. The book is what I call a cumulative argument. So it doesn't hinge on any one argument, and so if some of the evidence that I've reported turns out to be false, it's not like an argument where, you know, the chain is only as strong as its weakest link. These are rather independent kinds of arguments that all point in a similar direction. Now, with regard to the 9/11 Commission, it appears that unless things change rather radically in the next meetings, that there will have to be another investigation, and probably with a special prosecutor. I would say the most disappointing thing about this commission thus far is they have refused to use their subpoena power. Now, members of the commission got a lot of applause from the audience when they complained that Condoleezza Rice would not appear before the commission in public hearing and under oath. Well, why are they pleading with her? They have the power of subpoena. Likewise, when they're complaining that President Bush will appear for only an hour or now maybe a little more than an hour, and the same with Cheney, they should not be begging. This is what Max Cleland said before he resigned from the commission, that it was disgusting that they were going with hat in hand when they had the subpoena power. So one of my hopes for my book is that readers would look at the evidence and see what the really serious questions are to be raised, hardly any of which have been raised yet by any of the commissioners, and email them, write to them, implore them to read the book and to raise the kinds of questions that are raised in the book.
And again, I'm going to come back to you. For those who don't have time to read the whole book or, you know, have three kids that they got to feed, what are the questions? If you had five questions to ask key people, what would those questions be specifically?
Okay, well, I would just review some of the things I've just talked about. So one would be, why on 9/11 did not only one airplane reach the World Trade Center, but why did a second airplane reached the World Trade Center when standard operating procedures would have called for them both to have been intercepted long before they got that far? Secondly, how do they reconcile the physical evidence, which is available, with the official story that it was hit by a Boeing 757? Thirdly, I would raise the question about Flight 93. Have they investigated all the evidence that it was shot down, and that if it was shot down, why did the government then lie about that fact? Another one that we haven't gotten into today is the whole question of the collapse of the towers. Now, that's an extremely complex issue. There I could only ask the readers to turn to the book and see the evidence that suggests that the official account, which is that the towers collapsed because of the combination of the impact of the plane and the fire, is simply incredible, because the fire was actually very small and no steel frame building in history has ever collapsed, even with a raging fire. And furthermore, building number 7 was not even hit by a plane. There was no sign of a fire there till late in the afternoon. The pictures show that there's only a fire in 2 of the 47 stories. And yet at 5:27, that building totally collapsed into rubble on the ground. So even if it were fire, that would not explain the nature. So those would be 4 of the big questions. And a further one would be, why did President Bush on 9/11, and why did his Secret Service show no sign whatsoever of fear that they would be targets of attack? Because their behavior suggests that they knew how many planes were being hijacked and what the actual targets were.
All right. Well, these are very important issues for further study. We're glad that you took a shot at it. David Ray Griffin, your book is The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. It's put out by the Interlink Publishing Group, and we thank you for joining us on Flashpoints.
You're welcome, and let me add that people can get it very quickly now from Amazon.com.
All right. And is there a website?
There is a website if they want to... Just go on Interlink Books and find then the link to this, but also from Amazon.com. They can get all the information.
All right. David Ray Griffin, thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
You're welcome.
And a special event tomorrow evening, Thursday, April 1st, from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the College of Marin's Kentfield campus at Olney Hall. A discussion with Dennis Bernstein, Levinsky, Pierre Antoine, and Pierre Labossière entitled Haiti, What's Going On? Presented by Next Generation and Students for Social Responsibility. 1 month after the coup, learn more about Haiti's history, the recent overthrow, what the U.S. role was and is, current conditions and solutions to the crisis at the special public event featuring music, video, audio, web clips, and Haiti experts. That is tomorrow evening from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the College of Marin's Kentfield campus at Olney Hall. $8 donation, $5 for students 22 and under. Call 415-455-9498 for more information. That's 415-455-9498. And that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which is produced every weekday by Dennis Bernstein, with senior producer Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate producer Solange Echeverria, roving producer Miguel Molina, and contributing producer Robert Knight. Our technical director is Miguel Guerrero. Please check us out on the web at www.flashpoints.net. For a taped copy of this broadcast, please call 510-848-6767, extension 625. Email us at flashpoints@kpfa.org, or you can email Dennis directly at dbernstein@igc.org. Thanks so much to our web team of Kevin Purcell and Brad Smith, and thank you for listening.
There's much concern that Mel Gibson's movie The Passion will further inflame a resurgence of anti-Semitism. You are invited to a special evening called Who Killed Jesus? Exposing the Roots of Christian Anti-Semitism. On the panel will be liberation theologian and author Ched Myers, Rabbi Michael Lerner of Tikkun Magazine, Victor Lee Lewis, director of the Center for Diversity Leadership, and moderator Reverend Amazenia Lewis. This is at 7:30 on Saturday, April 3rd at First Congregational Church, 27th and Harrison in Oakland. Tickets are $15 and are available at our independent bookstores or at the door. This wheelchair accessible event is a benefit for the FCCO.